Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how spiritual practice and higher levels of consciousness can help us rise to the challenges of our current crises and make as benign as possible a transition to a truly sustainable human presence on our planet. I've held over 50 profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This session is a special one in many ways. I'm really delighted to be joined by John Hagelin, and this event will continue that discussion. We're titling it Only Higher Consciousness Can Transform Our World. And the way this will work is that I'll introduce John and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements. And we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in about 90 minutes or perhaps a little longer. Dr. John Hagelin is a world-renowned quantum physicist, educator, author, and he's also the president of the Global Union of Scientists for Peace. He's conducted pioneering research at the European Center for Particle Physics, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and he's also responsible for the development of a remarkable and highly successful grand unified field theory based on the superstring. It was featured as a cover story of Discover magazine, in fact. In addition, he's spent much of the last quarter century leading a scientific investigation into the foundations of human consciousness. He's one of the world's preeminent researchers on the effects of meditation on brain development and the use of collective meditation to defuse societal stress and reduce crime and social violence. And in recognition of his achievements, he was named the winner of the prestigious Kilby Award, which recognizes scientists who've made major contributions to society through their applied research in the fields of science and technology. And that award recognized him as a scientist in the tradition of Einstein, Jeans, Bohr, and Eddington. In addition to that, though, he's a true Renaissance man. I first encountered him, in fact, as a remarkably eloquent political activist. He was a three-time candidate for the Natural Law Party presidency of the United States in 1992, 96, and 2000. He's also the director of the Transcendental Meditation Movement in the United States. Dr. Hagelin has appeared many times on ABC's Nightline, Meet the Press, Larry King Live, and many others. He's been regularly featured in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and most other major metropolitan newspapers. So it's a real honor to welcome you, John, as my guest today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Terry. It's really a pleasure to be with you and with your audience today.
Well, wonderful. Well, to begin, you know, I want to acknowledge you because this series really focuses on the application of spirituality to a world in crisis. And obviously you began as a physicist and you did work that's widely acknowledged, even by your critics, even by the people who don't like the consciousness stuff. They acknowledge you did really important work. But then you, as a regular meditator, your consciousness was transformed and you became dedicated to serving a transformation of human culture. And here you've worked on the most inner levels by becoming an advanced meditator, teaching advanced meditators, and scientifically validating the unseen effects created by targeted groups of meditators. But then you've worked on the most outer levels by founding an independent political party, the Natural Law Party, and running as their presidential candidate. And that's how I first met you, is as a political supporter of that. And in this series of conversations devoted to asking if spirituality is evolving and if we can better understand how the intensifying crises of our time can be met in a better way by new expressions of higher consciousness. You really have a unique perspective. You've worked for decades at a very high level in both the inner and the outer approaches. And it seems like you've decided to focus on helping bring about higher consciousness by bringing meditation to more and more people at earlier ages. So I'd really love it if you could begin by describing this journey and how you came to the conclusion that this is the most productive investment of your time and energy now.
Thank you, Terry. Well, it began for me really as an inner exploration, an inner practice. I tried to request, when I was still an undergraduate at Dartmouth College, a dual major of physics and religion, because I thought, well, both really ultimately are aimed at understanding the truth, and both clearly have validity. Science has its objective and verifiable empirical approach. It's on a solid footing. And also, if the spiritual teachings of the world did not have truth, they wouldn't have served as a guide to human behavior for millennia. So clearly both are paths to truth, and if ultimately there is one truth, these two disciplines must be connected at their core. I made that argument to the dean of students, and I was rejected. I was assured there was no relationship between physics and religion. And honestly, at the time, there was very little. I had to choose, so I chose physics, less ambitious, perhaps, than religion, but at least reliable. And by the time I was a postdoc at CERN in Switzerland, however, modern science really had come to the level of the unified field. And at that time, it was in the context of what's called supergravity theory, which is a unified field theory, which reveals the unified source at the foundation of the superficially diverse universe. It was very profound, although preliminary. And since that time, it has moved in the direction of superstring theory and M theory. But the essence of it hasn't changed, and that is that, you know, modern science was in a position to corroborate the fundamental unity of life and fundamental unity of humanity, which is a central teaching of most of the major spiritual traditions. So finally, there was a deep connection between modern science and ancient science, ancient wisdom. And at that point, I became very, very excited about, I'd say, reignited on my path of inner awakening and inner exploration through meditation, became a teacher of transcendental meditation, which was an incredible training and just a wonderful experience. But, you know, as you know, and I think our listeners would agree, you can only meditate for a certain number of years before you start to see in our environment, start to feel in our environment, the depth of ignorance and problems due to narrowness of vision and short-sighted, narrowly self-centered human behavior and policies that are based upon that sort of short-sighted, narrowly self-centered behavior, nationalistic thinking, and you want to change it. And so, like many of us, we've become social activists and political activists, and we've attempted to transform the systems and bring about a more just and enlightened and universal understanding and universal policies based on a universal understanding. And what I found after 12 years of that, although worthy work, and I would encourage many to get involved with that type of activism, political and social, it also became clear to me that until you can change the consciousness that pervades our society and that pervades our voters, especially in a democracy, we get the government we elect. We get the government in a sense that we deserve. And we're going to continue to elect fear-based and narrowly self-centered policies and elected officials until we deserve and desire a better government and better policies. So I've come back more, although I certainly remain politically active, to focusing on raising the collective consciousness of the people. And in education, as we can talk about later, even in public school education, introducing the experience of higher states of consciousness through meditation to elevate society, and on that basis, we'll start to see a much more profound and rapid social transformation.
And you're doing that work in part, I think, through the David Lynch Foundation, is that correct? Would you like
that
to tell
correct.
Us about that?
Yes, certainly. And we can get into that more later also. But David Lynch is the renowned filmmaker, film director. He's a very interesting human being. His films are certainly interesting. I won't go into a deep analysis of those. But he is a very deeply compassionate and extremely wise individual, great artist. And he, like myself, gotten exposed through meditation to the experience of unbounded awareness and the transformation of consciousness that can come through meditation in particular, other techniques as well. And he realized, like I did independently, that we really need to transform consciousness before we can honestly expect to transform our world. You can't go sort of, you know, in a fit of rage against violence. You can't be in a fit of rage against the state of warfare in the world, because at that point you're part of the problem. Anyway, he created the David Lynch Foundation for Consciousness-Based Education and World Peace. And it was about introducing into education, and for all students in the world who want the experience, meditation. Meditation in the classroom, public schools. And that movement is starting to sweep the country and the whole world. And in the last 4 years, I think it has been 4 years, we have now taught about 500,000 students, especially at-risk inner-city students in public schools, 350 schools, as part of the curriculum. And that would have been, in my opinion, impossible even 5 years ago due to, you know, a lot of fear surrounding the idea of meditation, something that to many seems foreign, even Eastern, possibly religious, would conflict with the separation of church and state and all the sorts of concerns you might expect could be raised. And as we could perhaps discuss later, that those fears have really been overcome. They've been overcome, I think, primarily based on the acute need to do something different in the schools that will help our students cope with sometimes severe stress in our inner-city schools and drug-ridden homes and crime-ridden homes and economic hardship, keep kids in school, combat school violence, stress-related disease like hypertension, diabetes, even in young people today, and boost educational outcomes, expand creativity, really develop the brain for improved educational performance. And that's what's happening. And it's because of the research on those results and the concrete and undeniable transformation in the schools, the many, many schools that have incorporated now the TM technique as part of the curriculum. On that basis, it's really, really spreading rapidly, and the demand far outstrips our ability to fulfill that demand today. It's a very exciting transformation because it's deep, because it's really transforming an individual from the inside out through expansion of comprehension and consciousness in a measurable way in terms of brain functioning and so forth. Because it's deep, it's going to provide a more profound type of development than education traditionally delivers, and on the basis of more profoundly developed individuals with expanded comprehension, ultimately a new world. And I don't think there's any other way.
That's interesting. You don't think there's any other way? I've contemplated this a lot, and I've kind of come to the conclusion that there's no way except every way. But you're maybe asserting, and maybe on the basis of some evidence, that this particular approach of simply approaching people, and in a sense that's individual by individual, individual heart, mind, body, meditating, changing personally, that really is the senior or most essential approach, that intervening at the level of technological innovation and social transformation and all the different levels at which we can intervene are somehow junior to that and maybe valuable, as you said, but secondary or not as essential as that. Is that where you land?
That's absolutely where I land, and I think that was very, very well put. The thing is, you know, our brain functioning, our perception of the world, how we perceive the world, is based upon who we are, the quality of our consciousness, how expanded is our comprehension. And unless we can perceive and interact with the world in an elevated way, we're not really going to be able to transform behavior. I've taught in the prisons quite a bit, in the maximum security prisons. I've taught not meditation in the prisons. And the problem is you can go into the prisons where there's a great deal of stress. And in the brain functioning, you see the results of that stress, particularly in terms of the shutdown of the prefrontal cortex, the so-called higher brain, the part of the brain in the very front, which controls moral reasoning, its psychological maturity, its decision-making, planning, judgment, its the ability to consider the implications of our actions. And under stress, the prefrontal cortex shuts down. Under chronic stress, it shuts down chronically, fails to develop properly in children under stress. And the higher brain doesn't develop by the age of 25. They say it doesn't develop at all. And if you look at the brain functioning of people in our society, particularly in more stressed areas of our society, certainly the prisons are the epitome of stress, pressure cookers of stress, you find no activity in the prefrontal cortex. Physiologically, such a person without this sort of development of what's called the higher brain that sits over the primitive brain, the reactive brain, without the use of our higher brains, then principles of behavior like the golden rule, you should behave towards others as you would have them behave unto you. Well, on one level of expansion of comprehension, that's common sense. And you see that you can't, you know, mistreat others, or we'll have a society where everyone is mistreated. But if you take a simple principle like that and try and explain that in a prison through a counseling system and many of the programs that are in the prisons today, that simple rule simply makes no sense. What an impractical thing. I don't really care how I'm treating somebody else as long as I'm treated well. That's the kind of narrow thinking that's built into our brain functioning when the brain is underdeveloped in that way. So brain functioning and level of consciousness is fundamental to our ability to perceive others as ourself, to experience and to live more and more the fundamental unity of life and of humanity. It's all based on level of consciousness. And other than that, you could teach moral behavior in an environment where the brain is improperly functioning, underdeveloped due to stress, and you're really wasting your breath. So you need something that will engage and develop the brain holistically. And that's what higher states of consciousness are. They're not that mystical. From a neurophysiological standpoint, higher stages of development, higher states of consciousness, are simply the balanced functioning and utilization of the total brain. And all the benefits of higher states of consciousness, living the unity of life, living the scientific truth of the unity of life and every experience of life, that's automatic. It's a byproduct of a properly functioning brain. So without the level of consciousness, we're not going to succeed, for example, in solving the problems in the Middle East that have been there for generations, because in that acutely stressed environment, where you have generations of pent-up desire for vengeance and deep-seated stress, the idea of peace falls on, say, barren soil. You've really got to change, raise the consciousness, and that's at least what I've come back to. And with brain science today, our understanding of the functioning of the brain, the amygdala, the prefrontal cortex, we can understand even physiologically the critical importance of the development of consciousness to achieve a life-supporting, nourishing type of behavior and experience of the world, which we need to live a transformed world.
Now, John, I'm curious, as you describe all that, there are a couple of different directions we can proceed. One of them is maybe in the most personal way. Okay, so I recognize that. I've been a meditator. I've been changing my own brain function. I realize how important that is. But I do persistently come across the closure of mindsets and karmas and patterns, many of which are systemic. And, you know, for instance, if someone, you know, we have many people on the line here who are working perhaps as teachers or as doctors or other professionals, psychotherapists who are helping people, and the tremendous
momentum of trauma in human lives, you know, stands forth. So I think anyone working one by one comes up with a desire then to work more systemically, to have leveraged impact. And we see how these interlocking causes and systemic dynamics are tending to keep the karmas of trauma reinforced. So we want to change the game in broader ways. And we see that in many ways it's held in place by money, politics, by a variety of other things. We want to create systemic changes. So these changes in people's consciousness on a one-by-one level sometimes feel like they're low leverage, like it's hard to have a big impact on the system as a whole, working at the level of changing one brain at a time. How are you, you know, because to some degree this is not just a question about what are you devoting your time to, but then what would you, what is your advice then to the enlightened activist?
It's a very, very good point, because there are things systemically that need to be fixed. For example, in the political world, we're never going to get the sort of policies that actually serve the people of our country, let alone the people of the world, if the government is really, in a sense, run by the highest bidder. We do have a broken system. It's gotten much worse in the last couple of years with some of the legislation that empowers anonymous parties and corporations to give unlimited amounts to basically bankroll the candidates of their choice, secretly bankroll the candidates of their choice. And it's a problem. And that problem, unfortunately, has gotten even worse. How could it get worse? Well, basically, there really hasn't been enough awareness on the problem, or awareness on problems in general. People are a little bit too myopic, a little bit too narrowly self-centered to be politically very active. And what we need to do, thank God there are people who are doing it, and I've certainly spent 12 years of my life trying, to introduce better policies that are so self-evidently better than what we have today, that the hope is those policies will catch on and they'll spread like wildfire. They will overtake the system. They'll inject their way into the political dialogue. Some candidate will pick up those policies. Some politicians will see them as a win-win and start to push them through the system. So we have to continually try to introduce more enlightened policies in the areas of food purity and, you know, genetic engineering and so on and so forth, in many, many areas where the private corporations rule the government and fix the system of this revolving door in Washington, D.C., between industry and government and so on. And we have to keep trying. Depending, however, on how awake are the people and how insistent they become on their candidates and representatives that these things change, based on that popular support, those changes will take root, or they simply will vanish, which is more often the case today. So again, we need more people who are awake, who are aware of some of these issues, and are going to demand and elect a better government. But ultimately, we do live in an electoral democracy, and people need to know, and they need to, you know, speak through their vote, and they need to elect better politicians. So we need a broad education and broad elevation of consciousness to force through the sorts of changes. So we have two, I think we have two things. If I could clone myself, if you could clone yourself, we could all clone ourselves. We might have one of us working to uplift the collective consciousness, the level of consciousness of the individual and society, and another one of us who are, you know, political activists and social activists who are working for, you know, policy change and systemic change and hopefully finding a more receptive audience for those changes. There is one little thing to throw in here which has inspired me, and that is, and I've been very involved in this for a couple of decades now, research on the leverage that can be gained through collective meditation. It's interesting. Meditation is primarily an individual inner experience, and it is taught, at least in my opinion, taught properly, you know, one-on-one. And people are delicately, gently guided onto that experience of unbounded awareness, the immortal field of consciousness within, which is the most striking and dramatic change in the functioning of the brain. leading to higher stages of development. That's a one-on-one. But at the same time, research has shown, as predicted in the ancient literature of meditation, like the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali in the Vedic system, that the collective experience of the transcendental field of consciousness, unbounded awareness, the Atma, in the state of samadhi, that the collective experience of samadhi has an amplified effect on the environment, where the inner calm that comes from that state of absolute stillness, absolute contentment, can spread throughout our environment, not just our families and not just to our friends, but to the whole environment if enough people are collectively participating in that experience. It means meditating at the same time and preferably in the same place. When that happens, not surprisingly, from a physical perspective, you see a societal effect of awakening and calming and increased orderly brain functioning in the social environment surrounding those groups, an effect that grows roughly as the square of the number of people meditating together. The square, so that 100 people can have the effect of 10,000 people meditating individually and sort of at random. And that's, we could explain why that's natural, but it is an empirical fact that you can really produce a calming effect that reduces crime and violence, terrorism, calms, quells open warfare. As amazing as that sounds now, by this year, 2012, there are at least 52 published studies on that phenomenon of the effect of group meditation and group transcending on the social environment, showing that we are more powerful, perhaps, than we think, particularly in a group. And that is basically because consciousness is one. Ultimately, there is only one consciousness in this universe, and it is that inner spark, that inner wakefulness in each of us. But at a very deep level, not the level of physical behavior, not even at the level of mind or thought or even emotion, but beyond emotion, to the field of unbounded awareness, field of being, pure consciousness. At that level, even beyond the ego, is the I, the universal I, the Atma, where we are all one. And on that level, we are all interconnected. And ripples at that level, particularly many ripples, can build up into a tidal wave of harmony and coherence and peace with demonstrable, irrefutable effects on the environment as well. So we can raise collective consciousness of the whole world more easily, perhaps, than we thought.
Now, I brought this up in a conversation recently with a very intelligent and well-educated friend who retorted, well, then how come India is such a mess? Doesn't that look like a large-scale experiment that disproves your thesis?
No, it's a very good question. But people in India, you know, don't meditate. I just came from there. They have a tradition of meditation in India that really comes from the very, very deep science of meditation called yoga and the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. It's discussed in the Bhagavad Gita. Probably the classic text of yoga and yoga meditation is the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. But people don't practice it. They talk about it less and less. And the reason they don't practice it is that generally in the world, you know, particularly I think in the last 50 or 100 years, meditation has become kind of a sea of mud, I would say. There's so many misperceptions, misunderstandings of what transcending is, and so many different conceptions about how to have that experience that, you know, people talk about it. Occasionally they glimpse it. But there really hasn't been anything systematic enough, easy enough, universal enough that you could actually teach an 11-year-old in a sixth grade class to close their eyes and relatively quickly, certainly within a 15-20 minute meditation period, open the awareness straight away to that universal field of consciousness, the experience of samadhi. And it's not difficult, but it is delicate. It does take some training. It's very easy to see how techniques like this have come and gone and have come and gone and get lost due to their delicacy. But really, I'd say that there hasn't been that much hasn't been really that much in the world of meditation or relaxation or concentration today that delivers that experience that is so extremely exhilaratingly wonderful. And if you're faced with, you know, an instruction by your parents to go meditate, which means maybe go and concentrate for an hour, and you know how kind of fatiguing or just fill your mind of thoughts, you know how difficult that is and how tedious that is, it's no wonder people don't do it. And that's true in India. Really, people have, they have respect for it. They don't really do it. They don't really know how to do it. And it's not practiced in India. It's certainly not practiced in groups. Now, I'm working with, certainly many people are working on this, but I'm working on a program in the United States and in India where we will have in India, the geographic center of India, 9,000 advanced meditators dedicating pretty much their full day to the practice of transcendental meditation and advanced techniques of meditation, the so-called TM City program. And in the United States, where I happen to have gravitated here in Iowa from Stanford University to Maharishi University of Management in Fairfield, Iowa, we have a group of about 2,500 from the whole community that gather for long meditation twice a day. And it's these groups that I think, according to the evidence, it's group meditation and group transcending that has a powerful effect. So, I mean, India is not an experiment in group meditation. It's an experiment of what can go wrong in meditation when, you know, there's no systematic means that is universally effective and easy to have the experience that meditation is supposed to bring.
Okay, sure. I resonate with that, and that seems entirely credible. You know, I feel so passionate about these issues, John. My mind is popping off in about six different directions, and I want to follow this up with very rich conversation, but I guess I can only go in one. And the one that comes up that may be the most important to many of the folks who will be listening to us is to understand something about the form of meditation that you practice and teach and do your experimenting with, transcendental meditation, and its relationship to the other primary form of meditation that's being taught and studied by rational, intelligent, scientifically minded Westerners, which is mindfulness or Vipassana meditation. In my understanding, the two approaches, and you know, by the way, I began my whole spiritual practice with TM. It was my beginning point. I found a teacher and, you know, a few years later and moved in other directions, but I remain really deeply respectful of TM and grateful for it and respectful of how deep it can go. And yet the research that I have read seems to indicate that mindfulness meditation, which brings us back to the present moment and often to sensations and to the breath, and sometimes even people meditate with their eyes slightly open. It recalls a famous study that was done 25 years ago, I'm sure you're familiar with it, in which a click track was played to different kinds of meditators. And they noticed that inexperienced people who didn't meditate much would notice the click and their brainwaves would change. But after they heard it a certain number of times, they'd habituate to it and they wouldn't notice the click anymore. And they would notice it would slightly disturb them, but it would have a much smaller disturbance of the brainwaves. In deep meditators, and I think this would include TM meditators, as soon as they went into meditation, the click wouldn't register at all, which was very different than the inexperienced people. But then folks who were meditating in a more Vipassana mindfulness mode would notice the click as if for the first time every time it would arrive. And this has, it's always been a point of contemplation for me, this deep, deep absorption in higher samadhis, which where you go very profoundly to the most inner states of consciousness, tends to be different from the kind of meditation in which you simply arrive freshly in the gross waking consciousness in a kind of innocent beginner's mind, although that concentration could perhaps progress to a point where it would penetrate the gross to the subtler and subtler levels of consciousness. When I discussed this with Ken Wilber some years ago, Ken pointed out that he thought that what happens with TM, with a mantra, a deep classic mantra like this, is that we penetrate the sheath, so we go all the way to Anandamaya Kosha relatively quickly, and that this is the genius of TM. And yet, if we're going to see our world change, we have to be understanding the approaches that we use in a way that appreciates their differences, but also celebrates their commonalities. And I'm curious how you understand the differences between TM and particularly Vipassana, because it's so widely practiced and studied, and how powerful you think the effects are of widespread Vipassana meditation, which is almost always only studied in terms of its effect on the individual neurophysiology rather than field effects that affect larger groups.
This is a very good question, and actually a question for a longer discussion. I have a great respect for Vipassana. It does come in slightly different varieties, but just sort of generically. See, the mind, there are different levels of mind, different levels of thought. There's outwardly directed mind, which is basically sensorily dominated mind. There's a level of abstract thinking and very, very fine, deep, abstract, expansive thinking. Deeper than that is a fine, fine feeling level, which is extremely subtle, but at the same time very powerful. And beyond the finest feeling level is pure being. Now, as you rightly said, during meditation and during transcendental meditation, which does involve a sound or mantra that is somewhat specific to the individual, and more importantly, a method of using the mantra that invites, even entices, the mind to experience that mantra at deeper and deeper and deeper levels of thought, until it slips beyond the mantra. The mantra basically evaporates, and the mind is basically delivered, left at the doorstep of this field of infinity, our own Atma, our own pure wakefulness, at the source of all of mind and emotion and perception. Now that is a particular level, the transcendental state, pure consciousness, is a particular state of brain functioning, which is high amplitude alpha, but more importantly than the frequency being alpha 1, is that the whole brain is functioning in a highly synchronous way, in a highly coherent way. So it's a particular signature. It's a signature that actually shows the entire brain functioning in concert in a highly integrated way. Mindfulness and Vipassana involve a subtler use of mind and awareness, which involves, in a sense, you could say, a bit of a dispassionate observation and a very quiet internal process of reflection and observation. And it is a very quiet and subtle use of mind. And it develops, it's got a completely different style of electrophysiological functioning of the brain, completely different brain waves, and certainly much, much subtler than what you would call active thinking consciousness. Now, there are many, many things we can do with the brain, many ways to develop the mind, from taking a course in mathematics to, you know, taking a course in muscle building. There's just infinitely many faculties we could develop. The mind is incredibly flexible. And many of these different types of development are going to have useful applications to the personality, to behavior. Transcending, going beyond all mental activity, even the mental activity that is involved in subtle mental activity that is involved in Vipassana, is what transcendental consciousness is. And the idea of having that state of absolute silence and total EEG coherence is, well, on the one hand, to provide a profound moment of expansion and deep reinvigoration, re-enlivenment, and refreshment of the mind and body, and an more integrated functioning of the brain, which you take with you a little bit. You bring a little bit of that orderly brain functioning out into activity, But the purpose of it really is for activity. There's a more orderly brain functioning and activity which correlates with increased IQ, learning ability, creativity, academic performance, and moral reasoning, pretty much everything that's good about the brain. But more importantly than just developing our brains and improving our health, in my opinion, and the longer-term effect of regular transcending, is that that inner unboundedness and absolute inner silence, it's unshakably established even in the midst of dynamic activity, even in the midst of the deepest sleep or the most dramatic of dreams. Inner unbounded awareness of one's immortal self gets established. And when that's established, the brain and comprehension are maximally expanded even while engaged in specific activity. And that state of the stabilization of the inner state of samadhi with outer activity, which is sometimes called unbroken samadhi or nirvikalpa samadhi or enlightenment, doesn't happen overnight. It happens over a period of years of regular transcending. But that has the most transformational effect on all of one's activity, because then the comprehension is literally unbounded, and one is, in a sense, automatically a global citizen with this incredible quiet ability to compute what is maximally evolutionary in a given situation. And that's, you know, an effective meditation. And everybody, of course, from the Buddha to more recent figures, you know, understand the importance of the state of enlightenment. But the problem at the same time has been, how do you get there in a reasonable period of time? And that's where I think Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's genius was. In fact, he once described it as my only capability, my great capability is making the difficult simple. And you make difficult things like moving a boulder simple through what's called technique, the technique of the lever, for example. A small man can move a big boulder. A technique of transcending, just a sort of a revitalization of the greatest sort of trick of transcending that Buddha and his disciples used, which is sometimes called reverse hearing, which really means transcending through the sense of sound. And there are other ways to transcend lots, but that's one that seems to be particularly efficacious and seems to work for everybody. We could talk and should talk much more about it, but there's something very, very fundamental, most fundamental, I would say, about the experience of the unbounded cosmic self and the stabilization of that experience and activity.
Well, one of the, you know, this, I really appreciate that, and one of the things that calls to mind for me is that underlying this series of interviews that I've held over this period of time is a conversation that seems to be going on much more widely among people who have been meditators and practitioners for 20, 30, 40 years at this point. And some of them are seemingly asserting that this highest consciousness takes so long to attain, and even people who devote themselves to it, even among people who devote themselves to it, not everyone reaches the very highest levels, that focusing everyone on this long-term multi-decade project is an inadequate model for responsible citizenship, that what we need to do is to simply live on the basis of the point of view, the understanding that's revealed from that highest level, that we should practice, we should do what we can to be refining ourselves, but that the point is to live on the basis of what we've seen right now. Some people are asserting live on the basis of a higher commitment as the impulse of evolution. Others are asserting simply be the eyes of the love that you know yourself to be in those highest states without a particular purpose necessarily, but simply radiate that and be the presence of that as fully as you can. And your practice may never perfect itself. Partly you'll need to love your broken and imperfect parts, but that disposition can inform you from, you know, from the beginning.
That's beautiful. It's very beautifully articulated. I mean, my impulse would say all of the above. I mean, certainly we can all dedicate, I hope, you know, 20 minutes at least twice a day to, for the experience of Atma, you know, that unbounded, blissful inner self, which is very effective at developing the brain and expanding comprehension and elevating our thought and our activity, but it doesn't happen overnight. There's improvements, even overnight there are improvements. I mean, people coming back these days from war with the ravages of war stress and post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, with inability to function in society in many cases. I mean, it only takes sometimes a few sittings of meditation, a few doses of unbounded awareness to overcome those symptoms of post-traumatic stress. I mean, the effects of transcending are very powerful and I would say relatively quick. And that investment in time in our own growth really should be a prescription for everyone. But you're also completely right. You don't want to wait and establish the most exalted states of consciousness before you try and improve your environment, improve, you know, your own situation in life, but to elevate the life of others. And that's, I think, through a combination of radiating the love that we have within us and can be enlivened and kindled and cultured within us through a deep meditation experience and through the rational process of committing ourselves to policies that are going to be universally life-supporting in harmony with natural law, sustainable, in the best interests of the whole society. And committing ourselves to that, or all three of those, seem to be the best prescription.
Well, John, I know we're going to want to pursue many of these topics further, hopefully, and I hope we'll have opportunities to talk just personally and certainly in the Q&A that's going to follow in just a few minutes. But I'd be remiss if I didn't ask a question on a somewhat different topic while I have this opportunity. And that has to do with your work with the Grand Unified Field. I did a little bit of superficial reading, as best I could, on the internet to try to understand what your ideas on this topic are. And I what I got from that reading was that the characteristics of the unified fields that seems to be suggested by the evidence in advanced theoretical physics, as you mentioned at the beginning of this interview, has certain patterns and dynamics that are analogous, so profoundly and in detail analogous to the unified field of consciousness that is described in the highest by the highest mystical realizations in the highest samadhis, that the similarity of the two seems so significant that by analogy they could be the inside and the outside of the same phenomenon. And that's more or less what you're suggesting in your writings. Do I misunderstand you? Is that accurate?
That's extremely accurate. That was very well put. That has been my primary thesis probably for two decades now, that the unified field now revealed by modern physics is the same universal, unified field of intelligence that has been open to direct experience and has been described since times immemorial by the great wisdom traditions of our world. Now, it really even goes beyond, I think, what you very well described in terms of the similarity. First of all, in physics, you know, we've dug deeper. We've gone, you know, beneath the molecular to the atomic, to the nuclear, to the subnuclear particles, the protons and neutrons, and the quarks that make up the protons and neutrons, to deeper and deeper levels. That means smaller and smaller time and distance scales. And in the process of digging, peeling off layer after layer of the onion of existence and beginning to probe nature's inner core, physics has discovered diverse forces of nature like electromagnetism and radioactivity to be ultimately one. Two superficially different sides of one more fundamental reality called the unified electroweak field, for which Nobel Prizes have been awarded. And then from there, going to a much, much deeper level of reality, three of the four forces, strong radioactive and electromagnetic, become one. And that's a grand unified field theory that I contributed to in 1987. But since then, the smart money has moved on to completely unified field theories of all four forces of nature, including gravity, and all the so-called particles as well, like electrons and quarks and neutrinos, now all understood in the context of one indivisible wholeness, one universal unified field of intelligence that gives rise, stage by stage, to the emerging complexity and diversity of the universe, one unified fountainhead of all the diverse laws of nature that govern the entire universe. And that one universal field of intelligence has very crisply derived properties. And those properties, like intelligence and dynamism and self-awareness, are the defining characteristics of consciousness, intelligence, self-awareness, liveliness. I mean, consciousness is not inertia. There's a spark of wakefulness or liveliness there. And that's a qualitative correspondence, but if time allowed, we could really look into the quantitative, structural correspondence between the so-called unified field of physics and the unified field of consciousness and see that quantitatively, each has an extremely rich and verifiable structure. Verifiable by experiment, verifiable through rigorous mathematics, verifiable on the consciousness side through direct exploration and direct experience, as elucidated also in the scriptural texts of consciousness, like the Rig Veda, Sam Veda, Yajurveda, Atharva Veda, and so forth. And the quantitative structure, the actual mathematical structure of this field of pure inner wakefulness, in this field of pure, but this unified field at the foundation of the physical universe, that they are the same quantitatively and qualitatively. And then, of course, there's common sense. You might think that the deepest reality of human identity, human existence, which is our own inner consciousness, should be the same as that most fundamental element of everything else in the universe, you know, at the basis of a cup or a tree or a planet. At the foundation of everything, according to physics, is this ocean of pure intelligence, which is also the foundation of human experience. And it seems to me, as long as we're part of nature, the deepest aspect of our reality should be the same as the deepest aspect of the reality of everything else in the universe, in which case pure consciousness and the unified field of physics must be one. But yes, you said it very well, and that also helps us to explain how experiencing this ocean of consciousness within, particularly in groups, transcending in groups, could lead to the radiation, propagation of an actual physical influence of peace that can turn off war like a light switch in experiments that have been done and published.
Well, that description sinks me into the already perfect and there's no dilemma from that perspective. And the apparent crises of our planet, the questions that I've convened this series in order to examine, all appear as secondary to a more fundamental okayness and well-being that is the nature of all things. And as I stand in that disposition, I find myself paradoxically moving back and forth between two different orientations, one of which feels a tremendous responsibility to the apparently, degenerating condition of our atmosphere and climate change and war and political polarization and breakdown of institutions and financial crisis and the ways that affect so many people that we all know and encounter in our lives, and then feels a responsibility to engage that world from the position of that already existing okayness. And another orientation that simply wants to stand in the okayness and pay less attention to the details of the disturbance and simply radiate the okayness without engaging the details of life and suffering with as much energy and attention. And I think there's a subtler debate. I've been criticized by some of my listeners for constantly raising this question. I seem to be a persistent voice saying, we've all been given a koan by life. We're living in a crisis time with greater opportunities in terms of consciousness and luxury and opportunity. It asks of us to rise to meet it, and I keep persistently calling out that, you know, that koan. And so I'm essentially a voice for let's stand in the perfection, but let's really engage the so-called problem. Let's not look away from the ways in which that creates pain and hurt, and let's take that seriously. Whereas there's another orientation that kind of says, let's not take it so darn seriously. Let's not let ourselves get in any way bent out of shape or even go into focus on the so-called problem. How do you relate to that, and how do you relate in the midst of your obvious commitments, how do you relate to the underlying question so many people are asking, does this give me a basis for hope or not? How hopeful do you end up feeling?
This is a really, really good question. I must say that, like Ken, you are extremely clear and articulate, and that makes an interview like this a rare and delightful privilege. I would say this, like you, I and many people find ourselves torn a little bit between just sinking in, so to speak, sinking into that intensity of bliss and radiating a sort of a calm, coherent awakening that, you know, will have an influence, an inescapable influence on certainly family and friends and the broader society, versus, you know, rolling our sleeves up, putting on our hip boots and, you know, wading into the mud. And fortunately, for most of us, there's no conflict. Honestly, you know, you don't want to spend the full day in meditation, although sometimes it can be tempting. After a point, there's not so much to be gained by just soaking in this universal ocean of bliss, because the idea isn't to sort of escape life. The idea is to get soaked in it and then come out like a cloth dipped in yellow dye, bring it into the sunshine, and let the sun fade it. And it'll fade 95% maybe. Second time you dip it again, bring it out, it only fades 90% next time and 85%, and eventually it's color fast. And enlightenment is a circumstance where you can be fully established in this unbounded, blissful, universal consciousness while intensely engaged in the most dynamic and purposeful action. But in the meantime, even before being there, you can take that time for oneself and establish oneself in a position of strength and clarity and peace, and then go out, whatever we do in life, and try to move society, the individuals in society, in a forward direction, evolutionary direction. So you honestly can do both. I do know people, and I respect them very much, who are experiencing such, you know, beautiful progress in the unfoldment of consciousness towards enlightenment that, you know, they are very, very, you know, tempted to complete that great goal. And they spend a lot of their time in advanced techniques of meditation, and sometimes here in the big groups of meditators in Iowa or India or wherever. And I respect that, because if someone really can grow very profoundly, they are going to, even on that quiet transcendental level, have a big effect of uplifting society. For me, though, I don't feel I have that luxury, although sometimes it's tempting. I do take time for that, and it's absolutely the basis for the success I think I enjoy in the very, very, you know, many phases of my, what did you say, Renaissance life, which means I wear too many hats. But I enjoy some success, I think, because of establishing that state of consciousness before plunging into activity. But I do value the activity, and there's so many things that must be done to really speed this world through this transformation into what will undoubtedly be a better world, that I'm just compelled to do both. In terms of hope, it's a very good question. I am deeply optimistic. I do see and at this point, an inevitable transformation in the collective consciousness of the world, and as a consequence, every aspect of our world. I know that, you know, it may seem like we're living in a very violent world, and of course it is too violent, but in the context of history, we are living in a really, you know, a rapidly improving world. And certainly crime, violent crime in the United States is the lowest it's been in almost 50 years, and it's still falling. By the way, that really started to fall quite rapidly when we had a big, big meditating permanent group here in Iowa, and we predicted that that would happen, I guess it was in August, 4.5 years ago it would start, when this group was established. And since that time, honestly, there's been a very big improvement, a reduction in acts of violence across the whole country. So, I mean, I see many signs, not just that, of rising collective consciousness. And when I look at the political turmoil and some of the craziness and the debates and the whole political process today, which is what I see, is a relatively shrinking group of almost as desperately, you know, fanatical, narrow-minded thinkers who are desperately thrashing around in a shrinking minority. And I think that we will start to see a more balanced and expansive and progressive world. We'll see all kinds of problems with the way politics is run, including insider training in the Congress, which is starting to be addressed, and many other things. Campaign finance reform, I believe, will be addressed after this election because it's become so blatant. I think we're going to live in an increasingly enlightened world, and I think it's starting to happen fast. And I am very, very optimistic about the future. It's the nature of life to evolve and progress. It can be bumpy. There can be phase transitions. And as you said at the beginning of the show, we can sort of lubricate that transformation so that it's not so rough or rocky by, you know, raising the collective consciousness, increasing the deservability and desirability of the people. And I think that's happening. And I think the world is going to be, within a year, a markedly different place.
Well, thank you, John. I want to just charge ahead, but I've gone a little longer than the hour I promised, and I know many people here have questions. A lot of them have been typed in already. So if you do have a question for John or for me, please send your question by typing it in the instant teleseminar window on your computer if you're listening by computer. And if you've phoned in, please press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. And if you're interested to know more about John and his work, John, your website is hagelin.org, and a lot of the work you've described about getting meditation into the public schools is done at the David Lynch Foundation, which you can find out more and donate to by visiting davidlynchfoundation.org. Are there other ways that people who are interested to learn to meditate or to align with the orientation you're describing on a deeper level, perhaps if they're already TM meditators, are there any other resources or places we could recommend them, John?
I would also recommend, in addition to those sites, davidlynchfoundation.org, of course, is very inspiring. It's filled with incredible results and research on the transformation of whole schools through higher consciousness and through transcending. But for most people, I think a practical place to start would be at the website tm.org. And tm.org will tell you all about the transcending process and, perhaps more importantly, tell people how and where to learn. I think that for those who aren't necessarily already on a spiritual path or have meditation as a part of that spiritual path, I think that is, frankly, the most important sort of first and foremost thing to do. I might even say for those who are meditating through whatever method they're meditating, if they're not convinced or satisfied that they're experiencing unbounded awareness, this field of absolute silence and absolute abstraction, which gives a clear burst of energy and powerful clarity and coherence. If they're not, it's hard to describe transcending. I just gave it a try. If you don't think you're actually achieving transcendental experience and you'd like to, again, I would recommend visiting tm.org, because whatever other methods of meditation you may be engaged in, there is not only no harm, but a great benefit in transcending as well. Because transcending is just like turning up the rheostat, the dimmer switch of consciousness. When there's more consciousness, which neurophysiologically means more global EEG coherence, then whatever we put our mind to, whether it's our school books or whether it's our own meditation practice or spiritual path, it's going to be more effective. It's going to be better. So I would recommend TM.org as well.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, John. If any of you are interested to know more about my work, I will be offering a weekend seminar, Encountering the Beloved, in New York City, March 3rd and 4th, together with Deborah Boyer and Michael Pergola. And I'll be by myself leading a deeper 5-day experiential seminar at Hollyhock Farm in British Columbia, Canada, on integral leadership, June 10th through 15th. You can find out more details about my work and about those events by going to integralspiritualpractice.com. Maybe easier to remember my name, terrypatton.com will get you there too. Please stay on the line at the end of this call after the Q&A. I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with the series. In 2 weeks, I'll be in conversation with James Beres, one of the earliest Dharma and meditation teachers to follow Ram Dass, and the kind of the very first generation. We'll be talking about that, and I'll be talking about the other dialogues coming up in March and even the beginning of April, and then we'll open up the lines and hear each other's voices, those of us on the phones at least, so we can say goodbye together. Okay, looking at the questions that have come in, oh my goodness, I am swamped. This is a very rich body of questions, John, and I'm going to start with John Robinson in Dunedin, Scotland, I guess, has a kind of a long question. The essence of it is that he's been very struck, and he feels he's learned a lot. He's a very educated guy, studied physics, behavior and consciousness, and he's gotten a lot of benefit from the Seth material by Jane Roberts. And what he has found especially interesting there is the mechanics of how beliefs shape the creation of reality. And he feels like there needs to be more emphasis on how beliefs are formed and how they determine thinking, emotion, and behavior, both individually and in mass. And he, I think, is interested in your commenting on that. I mean, when I hear this, of course, I'm struck by the ancient teaching that the world we see with our senses in our waking consciousness is in many ways shaped by the animating energetics that operate at subtler levels, and that belief is a big part of the mechanics of that. How does the simple recommendation to meditate regularly relate to the way that limiting beliefs are shaping individual lives, sometimes in unproductive ways, and how can that be changed?
This is really a profound question. A wonderful listenership you obviously have. Yes, the mind even participates very actively in our processes of perception, sensory processes, and continuously filters and interprets the raw data essentially coming into our senses, and in that way, and it also very much shapes our perception of our environment. Yes, the beliefs we hold and those that are even introduced at a young age, this is why I feel education and even early education is so vitally important in shaping our world, shapes the world in which we live. It creates a lot of the biases and the bigotries and short-sightedness. It's really vitally important to uplift our, let's call it, our mental vocabulary to incorporate concepts that are more holistic and unified. The thing is, though, whereas belief does absolutely shape perception and behavior, consciousness is more fundamental than mind. Consciousness is more fundamental than belief. And consciousness, you could say, shapes or even limits our beliefs. And let me try and explain that. Again, there are different levels of thought, from superficial to profound, from the very specific, narrow, isolated thoughts to the more abstract and pervasive, bigger and bigger concepts. So if you're a mathematician, say you're studying math in high school or college, and you're studying arithmetic, and that's easy, you start studying integers and negative numbers, you know, okay, you can handle that, and you get to the rational numbers, and you sort of make sense of that, and the real numbers, and say you hit the so-called complex numbers, and all of a sudden, it stops making any sense. It's just too darn abstract. I just don't know what the heck the square root of negative one means. You hit a level, which is called one's conscious thinking level, whereby deeper, more abstract, more holistic, more powerful concepts fail to be comprehended by the mind, by the brain. That's kind of defines the limit of how far somebody can go in their belief system. Beyond that, they're limited by their level of consciousness. Or you walk into a prison, you try to teach better behavior to maximum security felons, which I was attempting for some years. And you try to, you know, explain a concept like the golden rule of behavior. As I mentioned before, you should behave towards others as you would have them behave unto yourself. Well, if people did that, we'd live in a great world. But there are people for whom that's just too big a stretch. They don't get it. Why in the world should I waste my time giving somebody to something else, somebody else, when I want that thing myself? So it's a question of the level of suppleness, subtlety, the expansion of comprehension or level of consciousness we have that limits our beliefs. Now, if you listen to the dialogue in the United States politically today, you look at the debates that are taking place in every state today, you think, how can people think so narrowly? How can they fail to see the importance of ideas that are more comprehensive and inclusive? It's just that those people who are speaking and the followers of those people who are speaking have an activated amygdala, are governed by fear, have a narrowness of comprehension, and an inability to comprehend, even if they wanted to, deeper concepts. So yes, the limited beliefs are a problem that restricts us, but our level of consciousness is fundamental to those limited beliefs. So yes, we need an education, we need a teacher that provides us, that offers us, it feeds us more expansive concepts, more evolutionary, progressive, and holistic, unified concepts. But we also need technique in the classroom, for example, to expand comprehension so that those concepts don't fall on barren soil. And that's why, first of all, I'm an educator. I fundamentally believe in the vital importance of education, but at the same time, I'm a consciousness-based educator in that I also understand the significance of including in education techniques that are simple enough but powerful enough to develop the full potential of the brain. And that, I think, we do spend, you know, a decade or two in education. And investing that much time in the development of ourselves, we should be living full human potential by the time we graduate. And then we'll have better beliefs, we'll have the capability to comprehend bigger concepts, and on the basis of concepts like the unified field, which is the biggest, the granddaddy of all concepts, the unity of everything, which is even beyond the intellect, which can only divide and discriminate. It's a concept that lives beyond the intellect fundamentally in the field of being. Living that reality of unity, we will enjoy a unified world.
Beautiful. Thank you. We are inundated with questions, John. There are people all over the world who are wanting to interact with you about these issues, and I want to apologize up front to everyone. I don't know, John, can you stay a little longer than our initial 90 minutes? It would be nice to respond to a few more questions than a hard stop at 11:30.
Yeah, Terry, let's take an extra 10 minutes or so. I do have a curriculum subcommittee of the Board of Trustees meeting that starts about now, and I will be late to that, which is okay. So this is too much fun to just stop, so let's go a little bit longer.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, we supposedly have 15 minutes, but we have, 80 questions, it looks like.
I'll try to give shorter answers as well.
Well, yeah. Well, one of the questions, maybe quickly, it's more technical, is what is your perception of the value of binaural beat technologies when one is using TM or Vipassana techniques? Can one deepen one's experience and speed one's progress using these HoloSync or other binaural beat recordings on headphones while they're meditating?
Thank you. It's a good question. With respect to Vipassana or mindfulness, I can't answer because I don't have direct experience with it, and I'd prefer not to speculate on anything if I can avoid it, just because there's so much that we can talk about that I can say with some certainty of empirical data. With respect to transcending, no, I don't think it's helpful. Basically, remember, the process of transcending is going beyond all perception, all thought, all feeling to the ocean of pure, abstract being. And there's something very special about the mantra. That is, I'll just explain why we don't just use any sound. My father gave it a try. He was particularly fond of the sound six-pack, which I don't understand the appeal, but in any case, certain sounds have the following quality. Any good mantra, by the way, would be a sound that is soothing and has healthy and life-supporting influence at every level of thought, from the surface level of thought, where we begin, where we're most familiar, to very, very deep, deep levels of thought, far beyond what is normally our conscious thinking level. Because if you're going to go deep, where the influence of thought is extremely powerful, it's important that the sound we're engaging has a life-supporting influence on our physiology, mind, and environment. But beyond that, mantras are chosen, at least for transcending purposes, with the following special characteristic. The mantra is chosen to be a sound that is more enjoyable, more pleasing, I'd say more charming at deeper levels of thought, at finer, earlier stages in the development of thought. And because of that trick, ancient trick, because the mantra becomes more soothing, more charming, more alluring, more enticing at quieter and quieter levels of thought, deeper levels of thought, the awareness given a taste of that direction of increasing charm goes there. There's no force involved. It's an automatic process, just like when I've talked too long, I'm getting a little bit boring, and there's some beautiful music in your environment. Your awareness will just go there automatically, without effort. It's natural, built into life, to move in the direction of more interest, more power, more knowledge, more and more. Because of that fact, mantra is more charming, more enticing, more alluring, more blissful at deeper levels of experience. The mind just goes there. And these sounds have been devised and treasured for thousands of years as being the most effective in that respect. And something we might dream up, a particular beat or sound, you know, is it may have some of that quality, but I sincerely doubt it's going to match with this very ancient and very pure technique of transcending that was advocated by the Buddha and others throughout time. Now, we can always experiment, and you know, that's the nature of our scientific age. But when it comes to ourselves, we only have one brain, and we only have a relatively short lifetime to develop the full potential of that brain and live higher states of consciousness. And personally, for me, I wouldn't want to kind of experiment and reinvent the wheel there. I'd like to use something that is tried and tested, long track record of experience, and hundreds of research studies and peer-reviewed journals showing that this is something that's 100% healthy and 100%
But these recordings are not an alternative to the use of the mantra. They would require you to hear, I don't know, rain or some sort of something, you know, in the background, but you could be attending to your mantra while you had the headphones on, at least in theory.
But you think that they would somehow distract or not serve
the essential value of the...
I think they'd be counterproductive because the whole idea is to transcend experience. And if you've got one object of focus, the mantra, getting beyond the mantra, basically allowing the mantra to dissolve and to fade away, leaving the mind alone in its own nature as unbounded awareness. If you have two things to transcend, two things to sort of slip beyond, it's going to be kind of a step in the opposite direction, in my opinion. I've been, you know, certainly I've been meditating for a long time to various types of music that might be in the environment, soft, soothing, of every imaginable type. And I've never found it to be an adjunct or helpful to the transcending process.
Okay, well, thanks, John. That's great. That's a question that I get asked a lot. I am humbled and pleased to get a question from one of my favorite actresses, Charlotte Rampling in The Hague. John, what is your highest vision of a transformed world through higher consciousness? Would TM help in reaching this if practiced by more and more people? And I think I'd like to tag on to her question, a question of my own. When you express that hope, what kinds of images of possible outer world transformations appear for you? What path for that hopeful orientation that has some concrete, tangible kind of images of possibility seem realistic and helpful to you?
That is a very interesting and challenging question for me. For one thing, of course, if more people are meditating and experiencing unbounded awareness and really developing in a demonstrable way the utilization of their total brain, total potential, developing their total emotion, capacity to love, that's of course going to contribute to the transformation of the individual and the transformation of society. What that society is going to look like, it's really a little bit hard to imagine. I mean, I have been in, you know, an assembly of 8,000 meditators for a period of time when that big assembly was held in 1984. And I can describe it was a rather miraculous thing. There was such what would I call it, super fluidity, super fluid flow, a powerful evolutionary force. You could, on a daily basis, you could have a thought that said, you know, I really should get together with Nancy Peterson. And you turn around, and she'd be tapping you on the shoulder. It was just an amazing, spontaneous, natural coordination of life. Everything seemed to be in this incredible flow of, like everyone in the zone. Now, it would be a community dominated by unity, which in common language means dominated by love. Because unity isn't something that's experienced on sort of an abstract, conceptual basis. Unity is lived as love. Love is a feeling of union, a feeling of incredible personal intimacy with everyone and everything. So it'd be a world of love, a world of compassion, a world of giving, where everybody gains, because everybody's giving, everybody gains. But what those social systems would look like, it's hard to even imagine, because anything I could imagine based on the level of consciousness of the world today is probably going to be far from the mark. If you look back in history at some of the, you know, beautiful records of the ancient past where there were golden ages, and the epic that comes to mind that is most like that is the Ramayana, where in Ram Raj, basically, Dharma was lived and enlightenment was a common experience of the people. Descriptions of that society and the benevolent nature of the leadership and the benevolent nature of everything, the order of things, it, beautiful, beautiful descriptions that I can't really reproduce right now. But you can look to some of those very enlightened sages themselves describing such a world, and it's inspiring, very, very inspiring to read. But I think if we try to imagine what would the police system look like? What would the penal code look like? What would the prisons look like? What would our schools look like? What would be taught in the schools? It'd be fun to speculate on those things one by one, but I honestly think it's going to be so far beyond anything we can easily imagine that my goal basically is to just create the conditions of enlightened consciousness everywhere and let nature, this incredible organizing intelligence of nature that governs our complex ecosystems in such majestic order and upholds the whole universe and gave birth to it, will easily work out, I think, a level of organization of society perhaps beyond anything I can imagine.
Well, beautiful. Well, in a rapid-fire way, I do want to take at least one live question, and there are a couple of I think, important and more personal questions that I'd like to surface. So quickly, let me open the lines to a caller from Dillon, Montana. Is this Eric, 406?
Yes.
Welcome.
Yes, hello, this is Eric. Yes, thank you. So, you know, I'm taking a breath and just sinking into the juiciness of this conversation. I hope it continues on the blog. You know, my intention as I go into this is just to kind of wrap back around to the theme of this series of how, you know, our spiritual practice informs, you know, our ways of relating to the world, and how, you know, what does that mean in terms of planetary citizenship? And I'm curious to kind of go back into these koans that I hear, you know, Terry living in, because that's very alive for me. I have done meditation for a long time, and I have a very strong call to activism and engagement with the political sphere. And so there's this movement back and forth between this, you know, dropping into a deeper place of consciousness and, you know, and feeling that okayness. And then, you know, also, you know, noticing, you know, all the struggles and suffering of the world and wanting to be responsive to that and feeling that tension of living in that place in a real way and wanting to be cautious about not using spiritual practice as a means of, you know, bypassing those responsibilities of citizenship as well. And that what I'm concerned about is sometimes there seems to be this gap between what is new and going to emerge. You know, I appreciate that what you're, you know, talking about of letting nature take its course, and, you know, something's going to happen that's beyond what any of us can imagine right now. And there's also this, it seems to me, practical thing of getting from here to there, and what are the intermediate steps that really require engagement and require me to, you know, push myself to step out in areas that are uncomfortable, for instance, and be part of a political process and try to shape that. And so I don't know if it's a specific question as much as how to, you know, live in that paradox of, you know, transcendence and engagement at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a wonderful question. Well, for one thing, you know, I, of course, ran for President of the United States and formed a new political party called the Natural Law Party, which eventually absorbed the Reform Party founded by Ross Perot. But the idea here was to enrich the dialogue, which, by the way, is in critical need of enrichment, the political dialogue, with ideas that are forward-looking, sustainable, prevention-oriented, and consciousness-based. And so activism is something, you know, I profoundly believe in. My own activism has shifted a little bit, having put 12 years into the political process and continued to be politically active towards education more with the David Lynch Foundation. And, of course, at 500,000 students in 350 schools, we're not nearly where we ultimately want to be, which is to provide simple, powerful tools for enlightenment and develop the total brain to every student who's otherwise wasting many, many years in an educational system that's supposed to be developing our full potential, but not. So that's another type of activism. And we will all have our dharmas and our you know, our areas of interest and expertise, areas of activity that are natural for us, whether it may even be being a good parent and providing, you know, our children with an enlightened perspective in our communities, or whether we're going to be active on a national scale. It's all really up to us. But I think I would add to that, our ability to positively affect change and to uplift the lives of others and to move society forward will be a direct reflection of our own level of consciousness. We have to be lit bulbs within ourselves, and you, you know, with your education and your voice carries that, with your meditation, your voice carries that. You are going to bring light and wisdom wherever you go. If you were to, you know, drop the meditation and over the years perhaps become a little tired and a little mentally crusty, or perhaps a little bit stressed, which is hard to avoid in today's society, you may lose a little bit of your deeper abilities to give on a fine feeling level, the deepest level of giving, on the level of love and expansion of consciousness. So I honestly think, you know, we need to do both. But in terms of the inward dharma, you know, we all need to experience universal, unbounded immortality, our own deep nature. But in terms of the outer path that we all traverse, they are as numerous as there are souls. And but we should all be cognizant of our responsibility and do what we can to bring our wisdom and enlightenment and love to the world around us.
Well, thank you, John. I'd like to close with a kind of combination question. Many people have asked personal questions about how they can engage with TM or with you. Debbie from Washington asks if there's a way of joining your Iowa meditation group online. Do you have an online meditation group? There's a question from Eliza in Toronto, asking how do we bring it to more people with the high cost involved in learning TM. We have a question from Charlie in Hanover, New Hampshire. Are the Indian meditators in Fairfield focused on any particular global topics now? And we have a question from Krista in Indianapolis. Is it possible to practice TM without having a teacher? And then Steve Hall in Charlotte, North Carolina, says he's been a TM teacher since 1973, although he's not so active now, and he has worked in educational reform, not so much involving consciousness, and although he feels he's doing good work, it's not transformative as much. He'd like to become involved in your work. How could he proceed? So a lot of people asking personal questions, being inspired. And
well, very, very good. Really wonderful questions. And again, your audience is a very, very impressive and enlightened group, and that certainly speaks very highly of you. It's no surprise. By the way, in Washington, if we mean Washington, D.C., there is a very active community and center in Bethesda, which you could also find at tm.org. And there is a coordinated meditation time for people who simply want to synchronize their meditations with a large group of individuals in that time zone, or even synchronize with the big group here in the Midwest, which is only one hour time zone away. All of these are very, very good questions. I think for many, the answer would be, by the way, you can always write to me at hagelin.org. There's a contact page there, and I'll get back to you with specific questions. In terms of meditating, I think tm.org is the best way to learn and get in touch with a local teacher. Personal instruction is needed, but it doesn't take a lot of that, you know, for a few days of individual instruction, and then one is really self-sufficient completely in the practice, so it's not hard. In terms of the high cost of meditation, it's really, you know, come down as far as I know how to bring it down, given the fact that it's a little bit time intensive to teach somebody. And the David Lynch Foundation for Conscious-Based Education, which I'm the president, offers transcendental meditation scholarships for all students and veterans currently. And as our funding increases, perhaps broader sectors of society, healthcare, the Veterans Administration, the DOD are starting to offer training in transcendental meditation for specific groups. We're going to be soon in a world where it's just a part of education.
And just like, you know, we, most of us have access to health care. I mean, most of us, and all of us have access to education. We will also, I'm sure, have access to transcending. We're just trying to work to make that possible as fast as possible. Anyway, I really thank you very, very much, Terry, and also for the wonderful questions that have come in. And you can be in dialogue with me. I think, I guess, the easiest way is probably at haglund.org and or through tm.org as well.
Well, thank you so much, John. I appreciate your staying a few minutes late. If I want to remind folks of the websites, haglund.org, tm.org, and davidlynchfoundation.org. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And you're invited to go to integralspiritualpractice.com to sign up for my personal mailing list, where you'll find other things than you get through Beyond Awakening and my newsletter. And you'll find out about my upcoming teaching events in New York and in Canada. And in 2 weeks, I'll be talking with James Barras, author of Awakening Joy, a wonderful, wonderful teacher and a deep human being. I highly recommend it. In March, I'll be talking with poet and sacred activist Drew Dellinger and the remarkable Austrian spiritual teacher Thomas Hubel. And then in April, the very clear, penetrating intelligence of Peter Baumann, formerly of Tangerine Dream and now the author of the remarkable new volume, Ego, the Book. Thank you so much for joining John and me today. Let's open up our phone lines and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Many blessings.
Thank you. Blessings.